Okay, 209, back on the record. Mr. Hogue, call your next witness.
I will call Mr. Chad A. Duvall.
Mr. Duvall, I'm required by law to advise you of the law regarding perjury in this state. Perjury is a false statement under oath of material fact made by a person who knows or does not believe the statement to be true at the time it is made. Perjury is a Class C felony. A Class C felony is subject to a maximum penalty of 5 years imprisonment, a fine of $5,000, or both may be imposed. Having been advised of the penalty for perjury, please raise your right hand so the court reporter can administer the oath.
I do.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Mr. Duvall, would you state your full name and your business address, please?
Yes, my name is Chad Duvall. My business address is 3121 West March Lane, Suite 100, Stockton, California, 95219.
I know in your pre-filed testimony you've given some of your background, but can you summarize that for the arbitrator, please, your professional background?
Sure. I've been in the telecommunications industry for approximately 17 years. In that time frame, I've worked for a variety of different firms, most of which are focused on providing financial and regulatory consulting services to rural rate of return carriers such as Missouri Valley Communications. I'm currently employed or currently a principal in the accounting and consulting firm of Moss Adams LLP, where I'm responsible for the direction of our telecommunications consulting practice firm-wide.
Do you have in front of you exhibits numbered 13, 19, and 13.1?
I have in front of me, it appears to be exhibit 13, 19, and 13.1, yes.
Okay. Would you describe those exhibits, please?
Sure. Exhibit 13 is my direct testimony that was filed on March 26, 2012. Exhibit 19 is attachment 1 to that direct testimony that was filed on March 26, 2012, and that is an analysis of minutes of use between business and residential customers for Missouri Valley Communications and Mid-Continent Communications. Exhibit 13.1 is a supplement to the direct testimony that I filed that is being filed today to make some corrections to the pre-filed direct testimony that was filed on March 26 of 2012.
With regard to Exhibit 13, did you make changes to that exhibit since the original filing of your pre-filed testimony?
No, there have not been any changes to the direct testimony. The changes I made are in a supplement to that direct testimony explaining what the variances are from the direct to the supplement.
Were you aware that the arbitrator had struck some of your pre-filed testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Hogue. Yes, that is correct. I was notified late yesterday that there was some of my pre-filed direct testimony that had been stricken from the record. So the existing Exhibit 13 in front of me includes that language that the arbitrator did strike from that pre-filed direct testimony.
Okay. And then could you provide a little more of a description of what the exhibit I've called 13.1, your supplemental testimony?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Exhibit 13.1, what it's designed to do, the supplemental testimony, in my pre-filed direct testimony, there were a couple of erroneous references to current FCC rules, when in reality those were references to the prior version of the FCC's rules. So via the supplement, what I wanted to clarify was what the previous rules were, the intent of the reference, and what the current rule is, so that I wasn't misstating myself in the pre-filed direct testimony, because I did erroneously say that it was the current version, or it led led the arbitrator to believe that those are what the rules say. Those were prior versions. So I wanted to make sure that it was very clear that those were prior versions and here's what the current version of the FCC's rules state.
Okay. Has Mr. Harrington seen 13.1?
Yes, Your Honor, I have. And just to be clear, we had a discussion previously and there was a correction to that language.
It is correct. That is correct. In 13.1, there are three references to dates, and those references are on page 14, where it says December 29th, 2012. 2012 should state 2011. So I'm making that correction to the exhibit here.
And that is in lines 11, 12, and 27 on page 4?
That is correct.
Do you have any objection to those changes?
No, Your Honor. We think they make it correct.
And I have made those corrections and initialed that in the official exhibit 13.1 here.
Maybe I'm not following. I thought that was on page 14.
It's page 4.
Page 4.
Page 4 of the supplement.
Page 4 of
okay.
the supplement.
Do I have a copy of the supplement?
Let me give you a copy. Sorry.
This is 13.1. Okay. Are we going to – is that it?
Yes. I'm going to offer 13, 13.1, and 19.
Any objection?
We do not object, subject to making sure that all of the portions that are supposed to be struck from 13 are struck in the copy that's given. I understand that was what you intended to do.
That is correct.
That's okay. Then we do not have objections.
Okay. 13, 13.1, and – 20? 19 are received.
Mr. Duvall, been a couple questions that have come up that the arbitrator has asked for clarification, and I think you're the person to ask. Can you explain to the arbitrator what high-cost loop support is?
Sure, I'd be happy to. High-cost loop support is one component of federal universal service funding that is designed for rural rate of return carriers such as Missouri Valley Communications that helps them to recover the cost high costs of local loop facilities. And in essence, what a local loop facility is, it's the end user customer's connection from the central office or the switch out to that customer's premises. So it includes copper cable to the customer's home. It may include fiber cable from the central office out to the customer's home. It'll include electronics that are designed to aggregate end user traffic in the field and carry that back to the end user customer. It also includes the associated overhead costs, including depreciation expense, maintenance expense, corporate operations, all of the costs of operating the business. In essence, what high-cost loop support does is it compares an individual company's what's called a study area cost per loop. So you look at that individual company's costs, and you do a calculation of what is their annual cost on a per loop or a per line or per customer basis. And you compare that per that study area cost per loop is what it's referred to. You compare the study area cost per loop to a national average cost per loop. If the company's study area cost per loop is high enough above the national average cost per loop, then that company will qualify for high-cost loop support. That high-cost loop support is designed to offset costs that are assigned to the intrastate jurisdiction in the separations process. So FCC Part 36 separations rules require us to split costs between the intrastate jurisdiction and the interstate jurisdiction. So high-cost loop support is designed to recover a portion of the cost of the customer's local loop that is assigned to the intrastate jurisdiction, but it is federal funding of those costs. In essence, what it does is it reduces local rates, or it keeps local rates reasonable for end-user customers, whether they be in North Dakota or whatever state they may be in. So it's a federal support of the cost of local service.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there anything that's unique about Missouri Valley's eligibility for high-cost loop support that might be different than other rural telcos in North Dakota?
Well, under what's called the parent trap rule, which is just a definition of a rule that the FCC has, that basically says that a carrier that acquires property, acquires exchanges from another carrier, has their amount of universal service funding, including high-cost loop support, essentially transferred over to them. So you're trapped at what the parent company had previously, the amount of support that they previously received. When Missouri Valley was acquired from, I believe it was Citizens, I didn't work with the company at that point in time, but when the acquisition took place, the parent company did not receive any high-cost loop support and didn't receive other types of support as well that we haven't been asked about, so I won't go into them. But the parent company didn't receive high-cost loop support. Therefore, Missouri Valley was not eligible to receive and does not receive high-cost loop support today.
Would you describe that as completely unique or somewhat unique for a rural exchange in North Dakota?
Based on some discussion yesterday and the understanding that there, you know, we weren't sure who in North Dakota receives support or not, I did look that up last night. Within North Dakota, there are 22 rural carriers identified by the Universal Service Administrative Company as being eligible telecommunications carriers in North Dakota. Of those 22 carriers, 19 receive high-cost loop support, 3 do not. Of the 3 that do not, I cannot say for sure as to why they don't qualify. I am vaguely familiar with 2 of the 3 and believe that the reason that they do not receive support is also due to the parent trap, but I can't say that for 100% certainty.
Thank you.
And just to clarify on that point, throughout the rural telecommunications industry, the vast majority of carriers qualify to receive high-cost loop support. Whether their costs warrant them actually receiving it is another question. I would say it's more the exception than the rule that a company would be limited by this parent trap requirement. Certainly companies that were acquired, there were a lot of acquisitions in the mid-90s that typically the parent trap rule did not apply at that point in time. It's more the acquisitions that took place in the early 2000s to mid-2000s, such as Missouri Valley, where that parent trap rule was in effect and limits the eligibility for support.
During the testimony of Mr. Kilgore, he was asked, or I think there was a question that attributed a belief, and I want to confirm whether you hold the belief or not, and that is whether businesses, as a general rule, or as a stereotype, originate more calls than, say, a residential customer does on average.
My belief is that, on average, that, yes, business customers do originate and terminate more calling than residential customers. I've not performed any studies. I'm not aware of any studies that would confirm or deny that. I have discussed that particular issue with other colleagues that are familiar with traffic patterns, previously had performed traffic studies, and their general belief was the same. But typically when a traffic study is done, you wouldn't boil that down to an individual customer level. You'd look at it on a much more global level, and you wouldn't say how much traffic is one customer originating and terminating versus another customer, or a class of customer versus another class of customer. So it's a generally held belief that that I attempted to confirm, but was not aware of any studies, have not prepared any studies that would confirm that to be 100% accurate.
Yesterday there was testimony, and some today, about the theory that high levels of reciprocal compensation motivate traffic pumping and other abuses that the FCC is trying to rein in. Do you see that potential for abuse if Mid-Continent and Missouri Valley are sharing, are interconnected physically?
I don't see that potential. Certainly the direct interconnection between the two companies has to do with the fact that they have customers who want to originate and terminate calling to each other. They have an incentive to do that, whether there be, regardless of what the reciprocal compensation rate would be, they both have the same incentives back and forth. Sort of perverse incentives that I don't recall if it was Mr. Gates or someone else referred to earlier, having to do with ISP-bound traffic is something, an anomaly is a situation that's long since passed. It was due to the fact that there were a lot of carriers who would basically give away local service to ISPs so that they would put their modems, hang them off of their switch, so that there would be a lot of calling coming into their switch and terminating on those switches. With sort of the advent or the growth of DSL and other broadband services, that's really gone by the wayside. I think Mr. Gates or someone else referred to the ISP remand order, where that ISP-bound traffic was determined to be interstate in nature and charged at a rate of 0.007 or 0.0007 cents per minute of use. I believe that that potential for arbitrage has gone away and wouldn't necessarily apply in this situation.
So am I correct in understanding your testimony to be a couple things? One, the fact that there aren't dial-up customers?
That is correct. I'm not aware of there being a significant amount of dial-up customers in the Williston Exchange. Having spoken with the folks at Missouri Valley, my understanding is their affiliate, Nemont Communications, has no more than a handful of dial-up customers in the Williston market. I don't know Midco's business well enough to say whether they offer dial-up internet access, but my presumption is that they would not. I'm not aware of other cable carriers providing dial-up internet access. It's primarily a technology that's, I don't want to say completely gone by the wayside, but end-user customers just don't look for 56 kilobit per second dial-up internet speeds these days. They're looking more for 10 and 20 megs. So it's a technology that's pretty much gone by the wayside.
And and I want to make sure I understood, is there a second factor, and that is the absence of an intermediate long-distance carrier that's sending traffic?
Well, certainly when there's a discussion of traffic pumping or phantom traffic, typically it has to do with there being an intermediate carrier that an originating carrier hands it off to that intermediate carrier without proper billing information. They then pass it on because they know the called to number, so they're passing it on to the terminating carrier. The problem with that is in the middle, when it comes to phantom traffic, no one knows who to actually bill that for. That's really the issue of phantom traffic. Now, traffic pumping is certainly a situation that a few carriers have participated in, some of which are what I would refer to as bad-acting rural carriers that have taken loopholes in the rules to artificially inflate their switched access rates, knowing that there's no competition for that switched access, and charging intermediate carriers or long-distance carriers those exorbitant switched access rates to terminate traffic on their network. And I say terminate, but also to originate traffic on their network.
Mr. Duvall, there was some testimony, I think, yesterday to today between Mr. Gates and Mr. Kilgore about the process of porting a Mid-Continent resale customer over and making that customer a Mid-Continent customer post physical interconnection.
Okay.
And would you agree that that process is more labor intensive than the process of simply what Missouri Valley has done here or is asked to do under the current arrangement where one of their customers is simply becomes a Mid-Continent customer?
Boy, unfortunately, that's sort of an area that's outside of my expertise. I'd be remiss to respond affirmatively or negatively. It's not something I have expertise in.
Right. Would you know, let me just ask you this, would you know whether whether in the porting process, Mid-Continent, Missouri Valley, or would have to roll a truck to the customer home during that process?
I'm just not aware. I believe there could be situations, but I shouldn't say definitively.
Okay. I think that's all that I have.
And Mr. Harrington.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am going to try to be concise.
You want to get on that plane?
I'll attempt to do the same.
For everyone's benefit. I'm going to start with some of the things you talked about just a few minutes ago. So you've been in this business since about 1995, is that right?
Exactly.
Right. I checked your testimony. So you were around for the FCC's original local competition order and through all the ISP-bound traffic issues and through traffic pumping and all of that.
I was very early in my career, yes.
You do not appear to have nearly enough gray hair. You talked about anticipating what kind of arbitrage issues there might be. And since you were around for 1996 and what followed, would you say it's fair to say the FCC didn't anticipate the ISP-bound traffic problem in 1996?
I can't speak to what they did or didn't anticipate, but certainly it appears to have been an unintended consequence.
Right. Do you recall the arguments in 1996 in favor of high reciprocal compensation charges?
I do not.
Okay. Did the FCC anticipate the traffic pumping issue arising?
Again, I can't say what they did or did not anticipate, but I don't envision, given what they've done recently related to traffic pumping, that they envision that being an issue.
And you have the same answer for phantom traffic? Okay. I guess you should say something. But
I'd want to get a better definition of phantom traffic, but I don't envision that the FCC intended for carriers to be able to pass traffic without appropriate billing records. Okay. So, yes.
All right. Let's turn to your testimony on reciprocal compensation rates. And first, you were here earlier during Mr. Kilgore's testimony when we discussed Section 51705.
Yes.
Which is now in your supplemental testimony.
Correct.
And would you agree with how he described how 51705 would work? I can refresh your recollection if you would like.
Please do.
He indicated that for agreements that are after December 29, 2011, that the rate for reciprocal compensation is set based on either the forward-looking cost or bill and keep.
I believe if you're looking for me to read Section 51705B2, that is what it states, forward-looking economic cost of such offering using a cost study or a bill and keep arrangement.
Right. Do we have a cost study here?
We do not.
All right. I am aware that you have removed your discussion of proxies, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the underlying basis for proxies at the time the FCC adopted them, if we could.
Sure.
And you're familiar with how the proxy rule worked.
Generally, yes.
Okay. So your earlier testimony was that the maximum switching rate for proxies was 0.4 cents per minute, just the switching component. Is that right?
I believe that's correct.
And did the FCC set a range for the switching rate?
If I can read from...
Feel free.
Although it's been redacted. The FCC did identify local switching proxies that ranged between 0.002 and 0.004 per minute at the discretion of the State Commission.
Right. And do you have an understanding of why the FCC set a range for that proxy?
I couldn't say for sure exactly why they set the range as they did.
I'm not interested in the endpoints, but why they would have chosen to do a range.
My presumption is that they establish a range, understanding that the cost for differing carriers would differ, or
right.
Different carriers would have varying costs, and so that they allowed for some variance in what those costs would be.
Right. Now, under the proxy rules as you described them, the former proxy rules as you described them, you had the switching component and you had a transport component. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the transport component, what did that cover?
Transport component covers the...
Our apologies.
I'm sorry, can you restate the question?
Sure. What did the transport component cover?
The transport component covered the connection from the central office to the meet point or wherever the two carriers were to interconnect.
Right. So, for instance, if the meet point or the interconnection point were a mile from the central office, you would then have to include a transport rate.
Actually, there are two components of transport rates. One is a fixed rate per termination,
right.
So per connection in the central office.
Right.
And then there's a mileage component that would cover the facilities, the cable or the copper or the fiber cable that then connects the two carriers that would be charged at a mileage-sensitive rate.
So if you're connecting right at the central office, the mileage-sensitive rate is not an issue. Is that
the mileage-sensitive rate of transport would not apply. You're correct.
All right.
Or a very small component would, but the fixed component of transport would apply, the channel termination rate.
People typically charge for 10 feet?
Actually, they do. Because it has nothing to do with the length of the cable. It has to do with the cost of the electronics, the equipment that's being utilized.
Meant for the mileage component.
There is meet point billing that there are very small percentages calculated at times. But typically, if it's at or within the central office, then there would be no mileage.
Now, have you been involved in arbitrations on reciprocal compensation rates before?
Yes.
And so you're familiar with the standards under Section 251D for setting the rates for reciprocal compensation?
Yes.
Under those standards, do you look to any existing negotiated agreements to determine the rate?
Well, in my experience, commissions have latitude to do a variety of things. Obviously, one point that they can take is bill and keep. They can look at a forward-looking economic cost study, or potentially you can use a negotiated rate between the two parties that's a reasonable approximation of what the company's costs are. In this case, we were pointing to the rates between Missouri Valley Communications and Verizon Wireless, as well as Sagebrush Cellular, as a reasonable proxy of what the forward-looking economic costs are of providing that service.
Under Section 252D, does Section 252D contain any language that permits you to look at a negotiated agreement to determine the rate?
I don't have Section 252D in front of me. I can certainly look at the FCC's rules. I'll take it on your advisement that it does not.
Actually, I'd like you to look if you could. I'm handing to Mr. Duvall my...
Rather time-worn.
My time-worn copy, which I think itself...
He did that last night.
Well, I will tell you that before this trip, it was only torn to about halfway down the page. But I believe this is a self-authenticating document as a consequence. And could you look at 252D2, which is at the blue tab? And please try not to tear it anymore.
What I can do.
I'm sorry, you said 252D2,
which is at the blue tab. And I'll ask again after you finish looking at this, does it contain any language that permits an arbitrator to look at negotiated rates to set interconnection rates in an arbitration?
I do not see any specific reference to negotiated rates.
Thank you. I'd like to move on to talk about traffic balance. And in your testimony, you provided, and I believe that is now Exhibit 19, is that correct? A chart.
Yes.
And that chart was, I presume, created as an Excel spreadsheet, is that?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm going to hand you what has been marked as Exhibit 4. This exhibit was provided to your counsel on Friday. Did he have a chance to show it to you?
Yes. Okay. I've looked at it briefly.
Okay. What I'd like you to do first is to review the first page and tell me if that is consistent with your chart.
Yes, it appears to be.
All right.
I don't see any differences.
Okay. There actually is one, but it's an additional piece of data that's not on yours. That's,
okay.
At this point, I'd like to move the admission of this exhibit.
This is 4?
This is 4.
The foundation's already been waived, so... I guess the only real ground would be relevance.
I don't have any objection.
Okay. Exhibit 4 will be received.
Thank you, Your Honor. So I'd like to talk a little bit about how you constructed this chart.
Okay.
To start with, and then we'll look at the other pages. You may have been looking at them already. So your premise is that business both originates and terminates more traffic than residential, which you said again during the live testimony, correct?
Correct.
And during the live testimony, you indicated that you had looked around for specific evidence on this point and that it was general agreement in your office, but there wasn't any specific study. Is that right?
I don't think I said in my office, but amongst colleagues, yes.
Amongst colleagues, okay. Do you have a source for the 3-to-1 ratio that you picked?
I do not.
So that's your best guess?
No, it wasn't an attempted guess. It was to show that if there truly is a difference between calls terminated by business customers versus residential customers, that this is what the impact would be.
Right. So your analysis, as you've done it, is sensitive to changes in the in the ratio of minutes terminated by business and residences.
That's correct.
So I'd like you to take a look for a moment at scenario 2. And I'm going to describe this as business and residential customers terminating the same number of minutes.
Okay.
In that scenario, it shows that the traffic would be imbalanced. Do you think that is an accurate statement?
That is accurate.
Okay. Now, we'll also talk about origination for just a moment. I'm curious, you say they originate more calls as well as terminating more calls. You indicate to me, that business customers on the whole are balanced as a group? Do you have any information on that?
I don't have any information, no, as to whether business customers originate and terminate a similar amount of traffic on average. I could not say for sure.
Right. Is there any reason to think that the proportion would be meaningfully different?
I think that there are going to be businesses that originate more traffic than they terminate, and there are going to be businesses that terminate more than they originate. Some of them are at balance. I can't say that.
Right. So like residential customers, then. Some will originate more, some will terminate more.
Certainly true, but I'm not comparing the total calling of one to the other, business to residential.
Right. But the actual amount of traffic generated by itself by a particular category of customer is not indicative of whether there's balance. Is that right? If I generate 100 terminating minutes and you generate 50 terminating minutes, that doesn't tell me whether you're in balance or I'm in balance, does it?
No.
Okay. Now, in your analysis, what happens if the proportion of business customers to residential customers changes for between the two companies? Say Mid-Continent and Missouri Valley end up serving the same number percentage-wise, same percentage of business customers, you know, 40-60 split for both of them, for instance. Does that bring you to 50%?
I believe that it would, but I've not run that analysis. I believe it's in here, though.
Okay. Would you look at Scenario 3 for a moment?
So that scenario shows where both Missouri Valley and Mid-Continent have the same percentage of total customers being – actually, that's actually not true. That's not what it does. I think maybe that was what it was intended to do. But it takes the total of all customers and then splits the customers to Missouri Valley and Mid-Continent customers in that ratio.
In equal proportion.
Right, in equal proportion.
All right.
So I'm not sure exactly what that's designed to do. It seems to be a very fictitional scenario. But
likely the perfectly equal percentages of business and residential customers for both is pretty low, we'll agree. Is that fair?
Well, in the end. I guess the statistics aren't up there, are they?
No, they're not.
The numbers in here would show that that's not likely to happen in the near future.
Also, the amounts that are shown on your chart, they're very sensitive to the actual rate for reciprocal compensation. Is that true?
When you say the amounts, the total amounts due.
You show a total amount due of $3,700 a month. Is that sensitive?
Oh, the reciprocal compensation.
Right. Is that sensitive?
There are minutes of use. There are amounts of minutes of use. There are a lot of different.
Right. I'm sorry. The amount to be paid in reciprocal compensation, is it fair to say that's very sensitive to the reciprocal comp rate?
Very sensitive to the recip comp rate as well as the balance of traffic.
Right. I'm not going to actually ask you to look at each of these scenarios at this point, but I think that covers these in particular. But I'd like to go back to one other thing about your chart. Your chart calculates the relative number of lines and then calculates the number of minutes of use for each of those groups of customers, correct?
Correct.
When you do the calculation of whether there's balance, you base that compensation on the number, that calculation on the number of lines. Is that correct?
Not sure I'm following you on that.
When you figure out the percentage of minutes, well, let me ask you. So I have. Let's go across the top line.
Okay.
MVC residential.
Which page are you on?
I'm on his exhibit, but it's also scenario number one of exhibit six. They're the same. And this is also in his testimony. When you calculate the MVC MOU and Midco MOU, first what you do is you take the number of lines for MVC res, multiply that by the number of minutes of use to come up with a monthly total minutes of use. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Then the next column, MVC MOU, is it correct that you're multiplying that 335,300 times the 35.85%?
No.
I'm sorry, not 35.85%. By the ratio of total Mid-Continent lines to total Missouri Valley lines.
That is correct.
Right. So, in
this what
case,
this
it's
is saying is that
61.14% for the MVC MOU line, subject to check.
Say that number again.
61.14, give or take.
I don't believe that number is accurate.
What number are you? You think it's the 77.71 number?
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. So that's based on number of lines. And then the Midco MOU number is based on the Midco total lines, and that's 22.29%.
That's correct.
Okay. My question is this. Reciprocal compensation is based on number of minutes exchanged.
Correct.
Why does it make sense to use multiplication by the proportional number of lines instead of using multiplication by the proportional number of minutes.
So if I'm following you correctly, what you are saying is that could take the, I'm looking at the Midco lines, Midco business minutes of 175,000 plus the Midco business minutes of 100,000. And use that percentage, 175 plus 200,000, so 275,300, as a percentage of 1,784,800.
Right.
I think that's certainly a way of estimating it as well.
And if traffic were, if each customer on average terminated and originated the same number of minutes, wouldn't that be really the only way to calculate it to come out with the right number?
I understand that that's a different way of looking at it. I haven't gone into it in any level of detail. I have to spend some time looking at it. As I look at the general numbers, I think that the answer is actually going to be very similar. If I take the 275,000 Midco minutes divided by the total of 1,784,000, I believe that you'll come out somewhere very close to the 22% that I've utilized.
Would you be surprised if the answer were that you're incorrect?
Let's do it.
As it happens, I was not going to introduce this as an exhibit because we didn't get it done early enough. I have with me materials on this point.
Well, why don't you hand the calculator to Mr. Duval?
Let's hand the calculator to Mr. Duval. Yes, let's run that calculation.
Boy, I'm not sure how to use this.
So we're talking 100,200 plus 175,100 divided by 1,784,800. Is that right?
I think that. Oops.
Approximately 15%.
The amount goes down considerably in terms of what they terminate and originate.
By approximately 6%, yes.
I don't have any more questions on this topic, but I'd like to, of your chart, I would like to talk a little bit about compensation I'd like to discuss a little bit the impact of reciprocal compensation rates and how they change the revenues for Missouri Valley. And for that purpose, what I'd like to do is provide you with a copy of Exhibit 3. Again, we shared this with Mr. Hoag on Friday. You're familiar with it. Can you tell me what this is?
Yes, this is a presentation that I gave at the NTCA, which is the National Telecommunications Cooperative Association's annual spring conference in San Diego. Don't remember the exact date. I believe it was in February of this year.
And this presentation, I like the title, The New Reality, is about the changes that have been made in intercarrier compensation and universal service.
Yes, it has to do with the intercarrier compensation and USF reform order.
All right. I would like you to turn to page 32. And I'm going to use the whiteboard for a minute here just to write some things and get you to confirm that you agree that they are accurate.
The mic.
And I will take the microphone. And on page 32, you're talking about the recovery mechanism that the FCC adopted. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And you talk about first determining the baseline. And there are three components to the baseline. Is that a fair characterization?
I would actually say there's four components, but there are three components that are then adjusted annually.
That's fair. So the first component is going to be intrastate
interstate switched access. Is that right?
Yes, the 2011 interstate switched access revenue requirement that was utilized in the National Exchange Carrier Association annual tariff filing.
Well, I'm going to erase that because I is not going to be sufficiently clear. Okay. And the second component is the intrastate switched access revenues. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the third component is net reciprocal compensation revenues.
Correct.
In Missouri Valley's case, those consist, to your knowledge, of the revenues from Sagebrush and Verizon Wireless. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, but there could be other wireless carriers as well. Those are the two I'm aware of.
Right, and that gives you a total. And that's your is that your baseline?
Your revenue baseline, yes.
And once the baseline is set, does it change?
Yes, it changes annually.
Right. It's reduced annually by the same amount percentage each year. Is that correct?
Yes, it's reduced by 5% from the prior year.
Right. But so when I set the baseline, I know what the amount I'm going to get each year is going to be. Is that fair?
Yes.
Subject to getting a waiver from the FCC or something like that.
Yes.
All right. When figuring out how you get back the baseline, can you tell me what the components are?
Sure. First, you have your intercarrier compensation revenues that include interstate and intrastate switched access.
And the second component?
Sorry, I wanted to complete that.
Certainly.
I just was waiting on you.
Yes.
Plus then net reciprocal compensation. So I consider that part of the intercarrier compensation. I just wanted to clarify what goes
right
into that intercarrier comp.
Okay, so we'll say
access plus recip comp
includes I will apologize. My mother was a school teacher, but she did not teach me how to do this. And the second component is?
The access recovery charge.
Now, the access recovery charge, is it correct that that's a charge placed on the customer's bills?
Yes, that is an end user charge that ranges from, depending on whether it's a residential customer, a single line business customer, or a multi-line business customer, can start as low as 50 cents per line per month and ratchets up over time to as high as $6 per line per month.
And a carrier is deemed to have charged that, am I correct, whether or not it actually does for purposes of figuring out its recovery?
Correct. It is an imputed revenue.
All right. And then the third component is?
The Connect America Fund. So any shortfall then would be recovered through the Connect America Fund.
Now, when you put all this together, the way the FCC looks at it is correct that first you say, do I recover my entire eligible amount from the revenues I receive for access charges from my customers?
Correct.
And then the next step is to add on the access recovery charge and see if that gets you to the baseline.
Correct.
And then the third step is you get money from the Connect America Fund.
Correct.
And in the end, you get the same amount, regardless of what the access and reciprocal compensation revenues were in a given year. Is that correct?
That is correct, assuming that the fund, the Connect America Fund, is fully funded and has the ability to pay all of the revenues that are required from the fund.
Right. We'll make that assumption for now.
You can. Others are
I
sleeping quite so easily as a result of that assumption.
But from the perspective of the rules as adopted, if Missouri Valley gets 3 cents a minute for reciprocal compensation or gets bill and keep from Mid-Continent, that does not affect the total amount of eligible recovery that the rules say it can receive. Is that correct?
It does not impact the amount of eligible recovery they receive. It does affect the amount of Connect America funding they have and the amount of funding that's eligible for other purposes. And the reason I say that, I want to make sure I clarify and that the arbitrator understands that there is a limited size of the fund. It's a $2 billion fund that's assigned to rural rate of return carriers. To the extent that there are additional requirements on that fund beyond $2 billion, the FCC has stated that that's a hard cap. They will not fund beyond that $2 billion.
And now payments that a company gets that are outside of access revenues, for instance, a settlement in a case or something like that, money that it gets because of a refund from a vendor, things like that, they have no impact on the bottom line for this fund, do they?
Can you clarify what you mean by refunds from a vendor?
Well, just for argument's sake, this is not in this case, but just for argument's sake, to pick something that's not access-related revenue, if it turned out that the electric company overcharged Missouri Valley and was required by the PSC to refund money to Missouri Valley for having charged too much for electricity, that would have no effect on this.
That wouldn't be recorded as revenue. I believe that would be recorded as an offset to expenses. So I'm not sure that that's a relevant example.
But the only things that affect the eligible recovery are inter-carrier compensation, the access recovery charge, and what comes out of the Connect America Fund.
That's correct.
So nothing else would affect it?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. I would like to turn now, and this should be, I think this will go fairly quickly, to the questions on non-local traffic. And I'd like to look to page, I think we've covered a lot of this otherwise. I'd like to turn to page 10, line 5, where you talk about transit. And
Okay. You
heard earlier the representation of Mid-Continent is not asking for EAS.
I did, yes.
In that context, would you be surprised to hear Mid-Continent is not asking for transit?
I don't know that I'm surprised or not surprised, but that's
right. So if
valid information.
If Mid-Continent is not asking for transit, this issue is not – the issues you raise are not relevant. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. On page 10, line 24 – you talk about the definition of non-local traffic?
Yes.
Reading that definition, it appears that ISP-bound traffic going to a local telephone number would be treated as local traffic. Is that right, in your view?
That appears to be. I think it would fit within that definition, certainly. I don't know that the FCC would necessarily agree that ISP-bound traffic is by nature local. I think the ISP remand order would address that.
Right. And your understanding of the current rules for ISP-bound traffic is that you're supposed to be paid at the rate of 0.0007. I think I have all the zeros.
Yes, 0007. Yes.
0007. All right. Just 1 minute to make sure I'm not missing anything. Well, while I'm doing that, Mr. Hogue asked you a few questions about the process for changing over customers. I'm not going to ask you anything specific about that, but I understand you have a fairly wide consulting practice. Are there things that can be done to make changeovers of customers more efficient?
As I indicated to Mr. Hogue, that's not an area of my expertise. I can't speak to it.
All right. That's fine. Oh, I'm not done quite. I do want to turn just quickly to Exhibit 3. And starting on page 47 and running through page 58. 58, 59, I'm sorry. You have a section titled, What Can Be Done?
Yes.
and I'm not going to ask you detailed questions about it.
Okay.
What page? I'm sorry.
It starts on page 47, which is actually not numbered. And this is, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this an analysis of steps that rural carriers that are affected by the Universal Service and Intercarrier Compensation Order could take to bolster their bottom lines and operate better?
These are certainly ideas that companies can or should consider in order to do that, yes.
Would these same ideas apply to a company in a competitive environment?
I think that they apply to all rural carriers, you know, whether they be in a competitive environment or not.
Fair enough.
They are strategies that are designed or directed towards responses to what the Federal Communications has done in the ICC and USF reform order.
I would like to move for admission of Exhibit 3.
The PowerPoint from NTCA?
Yep.
Yeah. No objection.
Exhibit 3 is admitted.
I'm going to take just a minute to make sure that... Oh, yes, I did have a question about the discussion of high-cost loop support.
Okay.
I promise this will be brief as well. The FCC made changes in high-cost loop support, didn't it, in the order, the Universal Service Intercarrier Comp order?
There are some proposed changes, yes, or some effective changes.
Right. In general, those changes reduce the amount of high-cost loop support available, maybe not by a lot in some cases, but as a general principle, that was what happened. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. There are certainly two major modifications that were made. The first of which is there's a limitation on corporate operations expense that's included in the calculation of high-cost loop support. So corporate operations expense is, in essence, the people sitting around this table. General management, legal, consulting, accounting, finance, things along those lines. There has historically been a limitation on the amount of corporate operations expense that can be included in that study area cost per loop calculation I talked about earlier. And that's based on sort of a complex formula utilizing the number of lines that you serve. It's calculated each year. There's a gross domestic product chain price index inflation factor that's applied to it each year. So it grows over time. That factor, that calculation has stayed constant since, besides the inflation factor, I don't remember the exact time frame. I think since at least 2001. So one thing that the FCC did was to update the calculation of that. So there are situations where that update increased the amount of corporate operations expense that a carrier gets to include in their high-cost loop support calculation. There are situations where it reduces the amount of corporate operations expense included in that calculation. So specifically to answer, right, there are situations where carriers are seeing an increase in high-cost loop support as a result of the FCC's order in that respect. Now, the other item is that the FCC has mandated that there be regression-based limitations on certain costs that flow into the calculation of high-cost loop support. So basically looking at cost nationwide, what's the average, what's actually the 90th percentile, and limiting carriers in certain area that their costs couldn't be above the 90th percentile of the nationwide regression analysis performed. So in certain situations, carriers who are impacted by that would reduce the amount of their actual costs down to the limitation calculated before they then determine the amount of high-cost loop support they receive. However, the FCC, so in that situation where a company is impacted by that, they would have a reduction in high-cost loop support. However, the FCC has also said that as a result of that reduction in cost, the national average cost per loop goes down, so there's more support to be redistributed. So carriers who have not been limited by that regression-based analysis actually have the ability or the potential to receive more high-cost loop support. So I can't agree with your statement that it would necessarily go down. There are carriers that will see their support go up. There are carriers that will see their support go down. Also need to warn that the FCC put what I'll call a straw man proposal for the regression analysis. It's certainly not finalized. They're going through that process right now. About a month ago, the FCC issued their peer review of their regression analysis that notified them of some significant flaws in that regression analysis. And it's my understanding through in direct communication with the FCC that they're in the process of significantly changing how that analysis is performed. So in the end, I don't think we have any feel for what the end result will actually be.
So in other words, some winners, some losers, some people about the same. Probably.
I would say, thank you for the clarification. Some winners, some losers, some stay the same, probably.
And your understanding is Missouri Valley does not receive this at all right now?
It's not just my understanding. That's a fact.
Okay. So they actually are unaffected by any of these changes at all in HCLS?
High-cost loop support-based changes will not impact Missouri Valley. However, those same regression-based analyses are to be applied to interstate common line support, which is a support mechanism that's very similar to high-cost loop support that's designed to offset interstate assigned loop costs that Missouri Valley receives a significant amount of interstate common line support and has a potential to be impacted there.
And they haven't adopted those rules yet, correct?
Correct, just as they've not adopted the high-cost loop support rules. However, the order does state that there will be regression-based limitations applied on ICLS just as there are on high-cost loop support.
But for the same reasons you said for high-cost loop support, we can't tell what the
results are. Right. We don't know exactly what those results are yet either.
I have nothing further.
Redirect?
Remind me. No, Your Honor.
Just to reconfirm. Okay. Let me just see if I have any. I might have a few.
Oh. You know what? That's correct. I forgot about six. Since there's no redirect, I guess this is probably the time to offer Exhibit 20.
Okay. Any objection, Exhibit 20?
I object on its relevance. It's repetitive as well. I think there was testimony from Mr. Gates that at one point in time, Mid-Continent or Missouri Valley back in 2006 was handling, I think the correspondence references 15 LSRs a day. That's what the correspondence seems to suggest, that they can handle up to 15 per day. And that's already been addressed by Mr. Kilgore, so I think it's repetitive and it's not relevant.
We think it's relevant to the extent that there's a question about whether the transition will be completed within a year. If there's an agreement the transition will be completed within a year, we don't need this exhibit.
Are you going to respond to that?
It's repetitive.
Okay.
There's live testimony that at one point in 2006 they handled up to 15 a day.
Exhibit 20 will be received. It's okay. Mr. Duval, when you were asking, when you were answering questions from Mr. Harrington about other arbitrations you've done on reciprocal compensation cases where you've been involved as a witness.
Yes.
He asked you about the formula, and you said you can use bill and keep or a forward-looking study, that the commission could use that in setting
Correct.
A rate?
Correct.
But not a negotiated rate. Is that right?
Well, I believe that the commission has some latitude in terms of the rate it establishes. One of the things that I had wanted to indicate was that in the FCC's rules, under Section 51.715, I believe it's B and D, there are some rules that state that, if I can just read this, upon receipt of a request as described in paragraph A of this section, an incumbent LEC must, without unreasonable delay, establish an interim arrangement for transport and termination of non-access telecommunications traffic at symmetrical rates. So it then goes on to state that in a state in which the State Commission has not established transport and termination rates based on a forward-looking economic cost study, an incumbent LEC shall set interim transport and termination rates either at the default ceiling specified in 51705C, which is interesting because those rules have subsequently been eliminated, or in accordance with bill and keep methodologies defined in 51713. It then further goes on in D to state, if the rates for transport and termination of non-access telecommunications traffic in an interim arrangement differ from the rates established by State Commission pursuant to 51705, which is as referenced before, the State Commission shall require carriers to make adjustments to past compensation. That leads me to believe that the Commission has alternatives in what it can do. It could establish a rate at something different as that forward-looking cost study is being prepared, or the default proxies that it references are being established.
Does the Commission, in your opinion, have authority to order the parties to conduct a forward-looking cost study, to participate in one?
I believe it does.
Have there been, when you talk about high-cost loop support and the parent trap rule, have there ever been discussions that you're aware of at the FCC to eliminate the parent trap rule, or did somehow?
The parent trap rule was actually recently modified, where previously the parent trap rule was stated that you received whatever the prior owner of that property received. So if they got $100 per line, you got $100 per line. If they got $0 per line, as in the case of Missouri Valley, you got $0 per line. The FCC has now changed those rules to state that you get the lower of what the prior carrier received, the prior owner received, or your own calculated costs. So what we now have to do for companies outside of Missouri Valley that got zero, if we have companies that have some level of support under the parent trap rule, we have to calculate it two ways: what the prior owner received, what their actual costs are for that carved out territory, to determine which number is lower. But no, I guess I don't recall the exact original question.
Well, I guess my question was, is there any possibility that the FCC is considering doing away with the parent trap rule or modifying it for companies that, like Missouri Valley, that wouldn't be eligible for it?
Not that I'm aware of. Certainly they haven't moved to increase eligibility for support. Any adjustments they've made would reduce the amount of support or leave it constant.
What does the, when we were talking about traffic balance, and Mr. Harrington had you perform, I guess I asked you to do it on the calculator, perform the calculation. When it goes from the assumption and ends up going from 21% to 15%, what does that do to the numbers, in your opinion?
What that would do is, and again, I'm not asserting that that is the correct calculation. I apologize. I would need to take the time to look through those calculations.
Well, the only way we would know the correct calculation is if there was a study done.
Right. An actual traffic study is the right way to go. In the situation where Missouri Valley believes that the traffic is imbalanced, I believe they have reason to believe that. Is it necessarily the right answer? We don't know. Only a traffic study will tell us what the balance of traffic is. But certainly the supposition that it is imbalanced and therefore bill and keep is the right approach, I don't think is a fair assumption either, because it's two parties making sort of bold statements about what they think the answer is, and they're 180 degrees apart. The only way of getting to the middle is really doing a traffic study.
Have you been involved in a traffic study? Do you know what that would entail in terms of cost or time or those types of things?
I've not personally been involved. It's not my area of expertise. I've seen them done. I'm familiar with firms and people who are involved in them. Generally, I have a feel for a ballpark cost, but I couldn't say for sure. It depends on who's involved, what the consulting firms or the engineering firms' hourly rates are, what type of information they're able to gather, what the processes are from each side in terms of gathering that information. There's programming that needs to be done in each carrier switch to determine how that traffic is going to be captured and so on. So it is a fairly complicated process. My estimation would be somewhere in the range of $20,000 to $50,000 to be shared by the two entities.
You have an opinion, I think you were here yesterday when Mr. Gates told us that he thought that the 3 cents per minute rate was an exorbitant rate. Do you have an opinion whether that would be an exorbitant rate?
Well, I've seen a wide variety of rates, including the rates that Mr. Gates presented as being applicable here in the state of North Dakota. I've participated in other proceedings, and it's dependent upon the individual cost of that carrier. Carriers have differing costs, and there are a wide variety of reasons why those costs differ. Is it on the high end of what I've seen? Certainly, I would say it's in the top 25% or top, maybe even top 10% of rates that I've seen. Is it the highest rate that I've seen out there? No, I don't believe so, including another one here in North Dakota.
In your opinion, does the Public Service Commission have any obligation to look out for the rural carrier in these 251A and B interconnection request arbitrations in terms of setting that rate? Do you understand my question, or is it too vague?
I'm not sure I understand it. I think if the general question stopped at does the Public Utilities Commission have the obligation to look out for the rural carrier, I would say yes, the Public Utilities Commission definitely has the need to look out for the rural carrier and the customers they serve.
Right.
Carriers like Missouri Valley Communications have a study area in which the Public Utilities Commission has given them a certificate of public convenience and necessity, and they are the carrier of last resort. And if their financial situation is such that they cannot provide or meet those obligations throughout the entire study area, then we have a significant problem because there are customers who are no longer served by Missouri Valley and have no competitive alternatives.
In setting out a determination of reciprocal compensation, can the Public Service Commission accept a rate or establish a rate in between bill and keep and the offered rate of the rural carrier and then have that rate have a glide path similar to what was talked about in some of the other rules?
Well, and I want to be clear that any rate that's established, so long as it's greater than bill and keep, will have a glide path. It will follow the same 9-year glide path as other intercarrier compensation rates do today. And so that 9-year glide path takes us from intrastate switched access rates to interstate switched access rates over 2 years. We then have parity for switched access, and then those rates over the remaining 7 years migrate slowly down to bill and keep. So at some point, say you established a reciprocal compensation rate that's 2 cents. Which is lower than the interstate switched access rate and is lower than the intrastate switched access rate. Basically, as that glide path catches up to that 2-cent rate, sort of in the middle, then that 2-cent reciprocal compensation rate would then glide the rest of the way along to bill and keep over the 9-year transition.
Who funds this Connect America Fund? Is it Congress, or is it somehow?
You do, I do, everyone. It's an end-user charge on interstate and international. Let me say it this correctly. It's a charge on end-user billed interstate and international telecommunications revenues. So on your bill, on your home phone bill, if you have one, you have interstate toll calling. You also have something called an interstate subscriber line charge. Your carrier, presumably here in Bismarck, is CenturyLink. They're going to assess you approximately 17% surcharge on those end-user revenues that you contribute, and it's going to be in a section on your bill that says something like taxes and surcharges or fees.
Okay. Does that also appear on a cell phone bill or just on a wireline?
I believe that it does show up on a cell phone bill. Wireless carriers, I don't believe, are required to charge it to end-user customers, but they are required to pay it.
So I guess what I'm getting at is that fund, when you alluded to the fact earlier that might not always be there or something like that.
Well, there's a $2 billion cap on the fund. So right now that 17% surcharge that we all pay into it actually funds a much larger fund that does a wide variety of things. But the rural carrier component of that is $2 billion. The FCC has not yet addressed reform of the contribution mechanism, that 17% factor.
Who sets the cap? Does the FCC set the cap?
The FCC sets it.
Not Congress?
Correct. The FCC has.
Okay.
Interesting questions.
I think that's all I have. You guys are welcome to follow up on my questions.
I just have one.
Go ahead.
In response to one of the early questions, you were talking about the requirements of Section 51.715 as you described them in your additional testimony?
Yes.
And I'd like you to look at 51.715A, starting in line 16 of your supplement.
Yes.
And you've actually bolded some language there.
Yes.
Is it your understanding that 51.715 applies when a telecommunications carrier asks for an interim arrangement for interconnection and transport and termination and applies only until the resolution of an arbitration?
I'm not sure I'm following that question.
All right.
Can you restate it?
Actually, tell me what your understanding of 51.715A, the first paragraph, is.
If you can, I'll read.
Yes, no, I'll give you a moment.
Are you looking at his testimony?
I am looking at page 5 of his supplement.
Okay.
What I interpret 51.715A to say is that you'll interconnect, and then it's pending resolution of whether it's going to be a bill and keep arrangement or a reciprocal compensation arrangement, and that B
tells you
how it's done.
B tell you the rates during the time before the arbitration is complete then?
It says an incumbent LEC shall set interim transport and termination rates either at the default ceiling specified in 51.705 or in accordance with the bill and keep methodology.
I'm asking if your understanding is that the interim rates apply until the end of the arbitration or some other time period.
Well, what D then states is if the rates for transport and termination in an interim arrangement differ from the rates established by a state commission, the state commission shall require carriers to make adjustments to past compensation. So, yes, it would be until there's
an arbitration
agreement or an arbitration
decision
by the commission.
So like this arbitration?
Correct.
That's all I have.
Mr. Hogue?
Mr. Duvall, I wanted to make sure that we had a correct understanding, because you said that the parent trap rule has been changed by the FCC, correct?
Yes.
Under that change, Missouri Valley still gets $0.00.
Correct, because it is the lower of the parent trap or the company-specific calculation of support, and obviously zero is going to be lower than any other number that would be calculated.
That's all I had.
Any additional witnesses? Mr. Duvall, you're excused.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Harrington, any rebuttal?
We have no rebuttal witnesses.
Okay. I guess that would conclude what we came here to do today. Before we go off the record, I want to address some of the technicalities. Is there anything else we need to do?
We discussed doing brief closing statements.
Yes. You want to do that?
If it's your pleasure to allow us to do it, we will do it.
Okay.
Cognizant of the time, I promise that mine will be brief.
Let's go ahead and do that first.
Okay.
Denise, are you okay to go with that? She looks tired. Want a break?
Look like a yes.
Well,
yes?
Okay,
let's give her 5 minutes.
We go off the record and talk about the procedural things,
sure,
and then come back on and
let's
do them after the closing.
Okay. Let's give her 5 minutes or so.
Okay.
Yep.